And she describes it by saying, "I knew you were going to be a good father as soon as that happened."
Welcome to The Art of Fatherhood, a podcast that takes you on the journey of fatherhood. Now here's your host, Art Eddy.
What's going on, everyone? Art Eddy here for The Art of Fatherhood show, and I'm very happy to have Duff Gibson. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me, sir. How you doing?
I'm great. I'm great. My pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Congrats on your book, The Tao of Sport, Reflecting on Purpose, Passion, and Growth from a Hotbed of High Performance. We're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about the Olympics. We're going to be talking about, of course, you won a gold in the 2000 Olympics in turn. We're going to be talking about all that great stuff. But I think something that you and I can say I actually have something in common with an Olympic athlete, Olympic gold medal, is that we both share our journeys into fatherhood. You're a dad, I'm a dad, and I love bringing good guys like yourself on the show. So, and everyone has a different fatherhood journey, and that's why I love having so many different guys talk about their path. And you and your wife adopted. We're going to be talking about, you know, of course, the adoption journey and all that stuff. But when you kind of realize that everything was going to go through, and you know, talking to other people who went through adoption, it's a long, tedious process, but everyone's like, it's worth it. When you finally realize, like, yes, I'm going to be a dad, what was kind of going through your mind, sir?
Well, it was my wife and I, we adopted from Ethiopia. And my initial reaction, I remember the phone call, and I remember where I was sitting, you know, talking on the hands-free landline, and where my wife was standing, and I waved her over because I knew who it was, and we were at the point where we were going to be matched. And they said, basically, this is your son's name, this is your other son's name, and they were given up. Their parents are alive, but they just couldn't afford to feed them. And so you, right off the bat here, Art, you're asking me something that's super heavy, and I'm a terrible, you know, I'm a very emotional person. So my immediate reaction was tears, and not initially that these will be our kids. Initially, it was these two young boys were given up because their parents couldn't afford to feed them. And the annual salary in Ethiopia at the time, and this was only 2008, so this is pretty recent history, yeah. Was about $200 or $300 a year. And so my first thought was, would $300, you know, which is nothing to a North American, could we have sent that to have prevented them from losing their kids? That was honestly the first thought that went through my mind. And I, through my tears, I said something to that effect. And they said, well, these kids have been given up 6 months ago, and I'm sure your $300 would do great things for some other family, but this has already happened. And that and then it changed. And so that's, you know, that's what it was. And my wife remembers that also. And me crying, and her, and she describes it by saying, I knew you were going to be a good father as soon as that happened.
I appreciate you sharing that, the story. And once you become a parent, once you realize you're going to be helping guide someone through their life, right, and trying to make sure that you're doing whatever you can for them, there's that selfless love. And even before like that, you were looking to be selfless and help a family, being like, well, what if we donate money so they can stay together, right? That's an act of love right there. I mean, just right there. And your wife is totally right. It's like, you're going to be a good dad because you're looking to put everybody first. You're looking to put your priorities in order so that, you know, your kids can live the best life. But then you realize, like, you and your wife are going to make these kids have a great life. You're going to make sure that they have every opportunity. So I love that. And for people who are, I mean, man, I think I could talk to you just an hour alone on just the idea of adoption in that moment you were feeling right there. But for people who are listening to this and thinking about adoption, what are some things you'd like to share that you've experienced that might help them?
Well, if you adopt in the province of Alberta, where I live, there are certain hoops that you have to jump through, and for good reason. And you have to take a course as to what is involved, what the timeline is, what the realities are of adopting domestically or internationally, what the costs involved are. I won't mention the specific country, but my aunt adopted and wanted to, that's my nephew, Alexander, and they wanted to adopt a sibling for Alexander, and they went to the same location, the same country, and they said, they got them to the country and said, we've accidentally given your child to the wrong family, but we can clear this all up for so many thousand dollars. And it was clearly a scam. Yeah. And they were in the same room with an Italian family, and the Italian family pulled out the checkbook, and my aunt and her husband walked away. And so it's, there are, you know, if it's going to be international, there are things that you need to know, and the timeline is different and the cost is different. And, you know, in certain parts of the world, there is, you need to be aware of the rates of fetal alcohol syndrome, for example. So that was a very important step. And I don't know if every, you know, jurisdiction would require you doing that, but that was very valuable. And for myself, I was just about to turn 40. So that made me too old for certain countries. For Pakistan, I think I would have needed to have been Hindu, that sort of thing. There were certain requirements and so on. And so that's why my wife and I say that Ethiopia chose us, in essence.
It just sounds like there's a lot of things that people should do to educate themselves on wherever they're looking to adopt, like the different procedures, what things can happen, right? Because it just sounds like, I mean, just hearing like, oh, well, we can fix this with a check, you know, and all that other stuff for some money. And you're just like, what? So there's, I appreciate you sharing that. So if people are listening to this and are looking, you know, to adopt, make sure, it seems like people should educate themselves on where they want to adopt, what are some of the laws and regulations, depending on where they're going, right?
Right, right. And it's, we went into it with, I would say, with a fairly open mind, and realized that there, what we thought was a limitless number of options wasn't really a limitless number.
Again, I appreciate the insight on that. And of course, people know, you know, your journey, Olympic gold medal winner, 2006 Olympics. Hard work, determination, of course, are going to be some of the things that you're going to look to instill into your sons, because that's what, you know, you had and all that, you know, striving to be an Olympic champion. What are some other values that you were looking to instill into them?
Well, it's interesting that you would assume the perseverance and this sort of thing. What I keep coming back to is the reality that you love it, you're passionate about it. When I was a kid, I watched the Montreal Olympics on television, and I didn't know what sport it was going to be. I didn't care what sport it was going to be. I just wanted to be a part of it and represent my country. And my wife never was on a national team or anything, but she figure skated all growing up, and she would still do it if she could. She loved it so much. She was the first one on the ice, last one off, that kind of thing. And we have two sons, one who's kind of like that and one who isn't like that at all. And it's we're really diving into the parenthood aspect of this now, but that took us a long time to learn. And I can tell you that kids are their own people, and our two sons are biological brothers. So they have the same mother and father, but they're completely different. And I've heard many people say that, and I've heard people on your podcast say that as well. They're completely different. One has all the talent in the world and couldn't care less. And it made me realize that, you know, talent and potential is irrelevant if you'd rather not be there.
Yeah.
Right? So they are who they are. That's something I learned in coaching as well, is how they should be, or your impression of what the right mindset is, to use a sport analogy, is not as relevant as to who they are and what's the best for them. How you think they should be pushed is not as relevant as how they will be, you know, manipulated or not. You know what I mean? It depends on them, not you.
No doubt. Yeah, you're 100% spot on. Like you said, you know, you mentioned like other people, other guests on the show, well, they'll talk about like, you'd think they'd be similar. But like, I always, like I ran into that trap where like I have two daughters and I'm like, I'm very different. You know, there's some similarities that I have with my older sisters, but I'm very, like, I have my own personality and all that other stuff. So for some reason you think like, well, they're going to be cookie cutters of themselves. Right. So like,
right.
If you have multiple kids, like, oh, those should be fine. But like, obviously personality and all that stuff comes through. So, and I appreciate that. Another great perspective is like, if someone wants, you know, you said like, you know, you had that passion, right? So maybe hard work and determination, of course, was in there, but you didn't see it as much of a painstaking job because you were going for it. This was your dream, right? And sometimes we get past that. So again, I appreciate you sharing that, because sometimes we get blinded by that because we just see like, you know, oh, they must be, you know, hardworking and all that stuff. But the whole idea is like, if you find something you love and you do it for, you know, your livelihood, you'll never work a day in your life, right?
Right. So, well, that is so true. And I for a while, I had a world record for being the oldest person to win a gold medal in an individual sport, I want to get this right, at the Winter Olympics. For a while, like, my uncle called me and said, your name's in the Guinness Book of World. Wow. Childhood dream check off there.
Yeah.
But, and so, because I was very old, people often say, what a tremendous story of perseverance. And it's, I always have to say, well, is it, what did I persevere? I kind of loved every minute of it. Does that count? Is that still perseverance? Not really. Not really. The truth of that cliche, you know, never work a day in your life. That's, I live that in sport for sure.
But again, you're just, I think now more than ever, I mean, there's with the internet, with social media, there's some bad parts we were kind of discussing about before we started recording this episode. But like, some of the good parts is you can actually hear from the person, from the artist, the athlete, the business person, whatever the case may be, because there's going to be assumptions and people can write about, like, even if they're watching someone, their mindset is going to be totally different than the actual person in that sport or business field or, you know, entertainment industry, whatever the case may be, right? So again, like, I love the fact that there's more people sharing, like, an athlete, because I'm big into sports. I'm a big sports fan. I love all things, not just like one sport in particular, but it's great to see like someone just kind of share on their own platform. This is what I'm thinking, and this is why, and all that other stuff. So you, again, I love talking to guys on the show and just learning about not only their fatherhood journey, but just learning about like their perspective on life. Cause I think, again, it kind of opens up, cause the more and more you can kind of see from another person's perspective, I think it opens up the world and you're more tolerable and you understand like, not everybody thinks the way I do, Art. So you gotta like make right. sure that you're doing that. So
you know what I find is that sometimes you get really, really candid moments, and probably on a podcast it might be the best spot, short of that person writing a book about it, because you're not just giving a snippet. I find, especially when you're referring to the mental side of sport, you know, before we started recording, you used the term mental toughness, because what other term, you know, that's truly, for lack of a better term. But there are so many, what a colleague of mine refers to as the mythology around a sport. And the example I use in the Tao of sport is Michael Phelps making his comeback at the 2016 Olympics and winning another slew of gold medals. And when people say, how is that possible? He did nothing for 2 years and now he's back winning more medals. Well, the answer is, the answer given on television anyway, when I listened, was mental toughness, training environment, the best coaches and trainers. And what they didn't mention was the fact that if you were going to genetically engineer a human to look like a fish, it would be pretty close to Michael Phelps. And that you can't, you know, mental toughness, I'm not degrading that at all, but you cannot, you know, you or I try to do that and it ain't going to happen.
No, but also too, I just something that kind of sparks my thoughts right now is like, I feel like we will say mental toughness or some of the cliches because we feel as like just humans be like, we have to have an answer for us to move on. We got to have something to be like,
that's mental right. toughness.
All right, let's go on to something else. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. What I would say, and partially why I was motivated to write a book about it, is that I've had an Olympic experience or several Olympic experiences as athlete and in various other roles where I've seen behind the scenes. And I can tell you firsthand that the champion is not necessarily the champion because they are the toughest mentally. The 50th ranked person could be just as or more mentally tough. It's just that's not what it's based on. It's how fast you cover the 100 meters or whatever it is. And I think we fail to, we you know, that's binary thinking, right? The champion is the toughest, the fastest, the mentally, the fortitude, whatever it is.
Oh man, I appreciate it. And having the title of the Tao of Sport is perfect for you. Just like just chatting right now, and I got to check a couple of excerpts from the book. But two more questions before we get into the book. For you, you know, of course, you like we're talking about the values and all that other stuff. Let's kind of flip the script for you. What are some of the things that you've learned from your sons that have taught you about life, or maybe something about yourself in general?
Well, I'd say we've already hit on one of the main ones, is that they are different and they are who they are regardless of what you do. And my eldest son, who's 17 now, had challenges in terms of his learning ability. He had has ADHD. And I think over the years, we've, you know, weaned him off medication and he's developed many effective coping strategies, and he has the people around him, and we make sure we do certain things because he'll tell you he doesn't have homework every day of his life, whether he has homework or not. That's probably not too unusual amongst kids. But what took me along those lines, and again, there's a tie to coaching as well, is I always assumed, or my wife and I, having never been parents of any other kids, always assumed that our kids should behave and react the way we reacted to our parents. And if you didn't do your homework, or you told me that you didn't do your homework, you were trying to get out of it and you needed a kick in the pants every once in a while. And our 17-year-old does not need a kick in the pants. It's more of a reminder. And it took me a long time, and my wife and I still struggle with this sometimes. It took us a long time to realize that he wasn't being sneaky. He wasn't, wanting to get up, and he wasn't shirking his homework responsibilities because he was lazy and a good for nothing kid. He was doing it because he was physically incapable of sitting still for half an hour at a time. And we didn't realize that at first. And it, you know, at times it affected our relationship with him because we assumed that he needed more discipline, and that wasn't the case. And that's something that I tell you with pangs of guilt in my heart, to express that. And it's taken us a long time to know. I can think of another example, actually, where my youngest son is, you know how you have some kids who have no confidence and other kids who have confidence coming out their ears and they don't deserve it and should never have it. Well, that's too much. You know, we make ourselves feel better by saying, well, if you had to choose between no confidence and all the confidence in the world, I guess we'd choose all the confidence in the world. But that's our youngest son. And there was a time when both my kids played baseball, and there was a time when he was, quite honestly, showing poor sportsmanship and making fun of a pitcher while he was on third base leading off. And we needed to do something about it, and we pulled him out of the game. This is, I mean, he was very young. He was only eight or 9 years old at the time. And we pulled him out of the game, and when he came back, he had to apologize to his teammates for behaving that way. And there were tears. And that lasted about a week, and he was back to his same old self. And I had, you know, which I can look back and laugh at now, because he's 14 now, and he's progressing and he's developing, and it's important that we are consistent with that message. But, you know, I've heard stories of, you know, other famous, you know, Bjorn Borg. There's this famous story about when he was a kid, he threw his tennis racket once and his mom locked it in a closet for a month. And he became that, you know, for people our age, you're probably a few years younger than me, but I remember the McEnroe and Borg, and Borg was considered the great gentleman of tennis. And that's, you know, it was one act by his mom when he was seven or something. It took care of the whole thing. And it didn't work on our kid. And I remember having a conversation with another parent on one of my son's baseball team. And he said, well, my kid threw his bat down after he struck out once. And I said, you do that again, and that's it for this year for baseball. And he never did it again. And it occurred to me in that conversation that that parent thought that every kid on the planet would react that same way and didn't understand why every parent wouldn't do that and we'd never have a problem with kids.
Yep.
You know, and every kid is different.
Every kid is different. And I kind of want to go back to something you said too about your son and like homework and all that and how you felt like terrible because it's like there's pangs of like, how did I not know this? I think we've all been there. There's certain instances with my daughters, I'm like, why'd I do this? And like, I think kids are resilient, but we as parents, we kind of, again, going back to unconditional love and making sure that you're doing whatever you can for your sons, where you're going to second guess yourself, you're going to beat yourself up mentally, and they're going to be like, they're going to be moving on, and they're going to be resilient. I think the older you get, you start to realize like, oh, I can hang on to things and like in a bad way, right? And start like second guessing yourself, and no matter, and not just in the parenting world, but just in everything. And
right. I'm thinking as you're saying that, I'm glad my wife's not here to throw her 2 cents in about me.
But like, again, like I appreciate the honesty, and I know that a lot of parents listen to this and be like, yep, I've been where Duff has been. And I think also too, you having that moment where like, you know, you pulled your son out of the game, like, hey, don't do that. And it might take a little bit longer. It might not just be a one-off, but if you keep on being consistent, I think kids will understand like, well, if I really want to do A and I keep on doing B and it's going to mess up me doing A, then I got to stop doing B. Right. And it's going to take like with this pandemic, you have seen kids thrive in a virtual setting compared to people who need to be in a classroom. And there's no
right
one way that you need to learn. Everybody is different. And I think that the idea of like, there's one cookie cutter way to do things. Hopefully more and more will realize from this pandemic, it's like, there are different ways to get to your destination, and everyone has different tastes, different ways of learning, different ways of just coping with things. So again, I appreciate you sharing that, because there's a lot of things that a lot of parents can relate to about your experiences as being a dad and, you know, just interacting with your kids. And I think there's a lot of things that people can take away from our conversation already, but if there's one big piece of advice you'd offer to new dads listening to this, what would it be?
Well, you know, I was listening to another episode of your podcast, and so I kind of knew this question was coming. And so, as you know, my kids were adopted, and my youngest was 11 months old when they came home. And I would say, more than anything, that moment in, and this isn't about parenting, this is about enjoying the moment. That period of time where they fall asleep when you're holding them and they put their head, I'm just, you know, this will be audio only, and yeah. I'm showing you over the Zoom call. When they put their head in the crux of your neck there and your arms get tired, tough it out. Tough it out, because that sit down, brace your arm, whatever it is, because that moment is gone like that. And that, you know, my kids grew a lot pretty early on. So, you know, our youngest was still okay to hold hands with dad when he was like 7 or 8 or something. And then overnight, it's like, are you kidding me? Let go of me. You know, I'd rather hang around with my friends. You know, that kind of a thing changes. And it's very tough for a parent to go through. And I think, you know, as a dad, I think back to one of the most beautiful moments of my life was exactly what I just described to you. I was coaching away, got back off an airplane, been away 3 weeks. My youngest was still, you know, he would have been 2 maybe. Jen handed him to me asleep. His head's in that part of my neck. He wakes up, says, oh, Papa, gives me a hug, falls back to sleep. Oh. And that's gone. You know, that's just a beautiful memory now.
Yeah, you're taking me back to when my kids are 13 and 11. And I just, you just think about those times. And I feel like, especially Facebook, they hit you with those like memory bomb, yeah. Right? It's like, hey, this happened 12 years ago, or it happened like 7 years ago. Like, oh, they were so tiny. And you're just like, you get, I wrote an article just about like how, you know, time is all relative, but like Facebook, just the memories hit you. And it's like with a gut shot, you're like, oh man, time is flying by so fast. Right.
So, yeah. And the old man in me goes, that was only 8 years ago. That's not that long ago, but they're just so dramatically different.
Yeah. And another aspect I got to ask you, you must have some cool dad street cred being an Olympic gold medal winner, right?
Well, I would have always thought so. If you asked me, would I have, you know, this is, dads everywhere are going, well, I think I'm cool. But I think the only way I can describe it is that it's just a normal occurrence. They don't know any different, I guess. But the only times that, you know, someone had in public would have, the two times in my life where someone had recognized me as an Olympian or something, my kids would say to their mom, what did that man want with Papa? What is he talking about? So they have no idea. But there's one story in which I like to share. I think it's really funny and speaks to their not being really impressed with an Olympic gold medal. And that was after I was done in 06, I became a coach. And in the summer leading up to the Vancouver Whistler Olympics, so it would have been the summer of 09, there's a giant set of stairs just north of downtown here in Calgary that we sometimes, I used to train there. And when we were coaching, we had the athletes training there, and you'd sprint up to two or three stairs at a time and do jumps and that kind of a training. And we'd be there for an hour at a time, maybe, or longer. And there was no washroom. And on this occasion in the summer of 2009, my eldest son was there, and he would have been five, I think, or somewhere in that neighborhood. And at one point he came up to me and he said, Papa, you see that guy over there? And I went, oh, John, referring to John Montgomery, who was subsequently going to win the gold medal in skeleton, at the 2010 Olympics. John there. He said he was going into the bushes to look for bugs, but he wasn't. He was going to the bathroom. And I didn't think anything of it at the time, other than I don't know why John didn't just say, get lost, kid, I'm trying to go to the bathroom. But flash forward to the Vancouver Whistler Olympics, and John, and I'm there as a commentator, and John wins gold, and it's this incredible race. And that night, or maybe the next morning, I'm calling home to check in, and I talk to my son on the phone, and I say, did you watch it last night? John won a gold medal. You know John. And he said, yeah, I know John. He's the guy who said he was looking for bugs, but he wasn't. He was peeing. And so that's my only saving grace, that's just my kids. Not, you got to bring something more than an Olympic gold medal if you want to impress my kids.
I love that. Yeah, because I think so, like, you know, dads listeners who haven't won a gold medal like myself, being like, all right, so it's okay.
Yeah, there's no way out. You're not cool. That's all there is to it.
Oh, that's awesome. Love it. Your book, The Talent of Sport, Reflecting on Purpose, Passion, and the Growth of a Hotbed of High Performance. Just talking to you right now, and I see that you look at everything from just kind of different points of view, which I think is fantastic. So I could see why you wanted to write this book. But for you personally, in your own words, what was the inspiration to write this book, sir?
Well, a few things. As I mentioned, I watched the Montreal Olympics before my 10th birthday, and then became Olympics obsessed. And that really hasn't changed. But I had that whole career of chasing it, ended up going to two Olympics, coached for two more. And now I don't really, I run a kids multi-sport program. I'm a firefighter by trade, but in my only relationship with sport now is my own kids and a kids multi-sport program called Dark Horse. So I obsessed with something, it related specifically to the Olympics. So it was very high performance focused. And the thought that I would have put all this mental energy into something and not be involved anymore, I wanted to pass on that information. And truly, Calgary is a hotbed of Olympic sport, and some of the all-time greats in the winter sports specifically were my contemporaries. And I shared, you know, I was on the same teams with them, and I shared the same facilities with them and had conversations with them. And I feel there is a commonality amongst successful people. And I thought that there's some great messages there that I wanted to pass along. And another part of it was the fact that I remember my youngest son, and this is when he was 8. This was just when my coaching career was over after the Sochi Olympics. And I watched his hockey game. So 8-year-olds, and it was Division II. So in other words, there was a whole nother level of crazy parent above that. And in Division II, his coach was not at him, but at one of his teammates, yelling something at a player, and the player didn't know what to do. And the coach grabbed him by the jersey and ripped him off the ice. And on the way home, my son, who was 8 at the time, as I mentioned, said, "Man, coach takes this way too seriously." And I thought it was such an interesting, from a psychological perspective, what is it about that environment that is that the adult is ignorant to, that the 8-year-old is keenly aware of? And I also thought, you know, I just came from coaching the national team at the last Olympics, and we would never have tolerated that behavior. We would have seen it as disruptive, and we would have literally had someone behaving like that removed from the program. And it's okay for 8-year-olds. It makes absolutely no sense. And so, reflecting back, you know, I publish a book now called The Tao of Sport, as if I'm the Zen master of sports. But it's the reality is that, you know, like parenting, a lot of the conclusions I have come to comes from doing it the wrong way as often as it is about doing it the right way. And so I've been in those situations where skeleton is an individual sport. Your teammate is also your competition. And I had a teammate who was the best in the world when I joined the team. And it was like, well, I'm not going to help you to get better to challenge me. Yeah. And so we had that team that was not a team. And then eventually we became that true team. And so I've experienced that on both sides. And so that's part of it as well.
Again, I think you and I could have like a full day conversation about all of these different things, because you bring up so many great points. You're the writer of this book, and everyone takes in medium differently, right? So, but yeah. When people are reading this, what do you hope that people will take away? Because again, I know everyone's going to take in it differently, but is there a couple of themes that you hope people take away from this?
Well, I think my answer to that is exactly what you said. People will take something different from it. Every individual will take something different from it. It's a lot of it is very high performance, like going to an Olympics. A lot of people fail at an Olympics because they're walking around in an environment that's oddly positive and supportive, and you're so excited, and you're in the same dorm with someone you watched win an Olympic gold the last time around. And then you can't fall asleep when you normally would fall asleep, and you're already dealing with jet lag anyway. And then, you know, I use the example of the 4-man bobsleigh at the Torino Olympics, where the Canadian finished 4th, 800ths of a second out of 3rd. And that begs the question, well, what's the difference? What could have made the difference? Well, it's less than 1/100 of a second on each of the 4 pushes. And so could that have been decided by someone not getting a good enough sleep? Absolutely, that could have been decided by that. So that's a very high performance concept. But it's what I found when you're talking about the mental side of sport is that the foundation is something that happens when you're a kid. So I end up talking about youth sport quite a bit. And I, on the other end of it, I talk about giving back and understanding what the great beauty of sport is, and then how do you pass that on? So it's very, you know, it covers many different perspectives. And so what do I hope people take from it? I hope they see. And so this is a very broad answer for something that, you know, some people are going to relate to the high performance aspect. Some people aren't going to relate to the parent stuff at all.
Yeah.
But in general terms, what I would say is that very successful people don't look at their competition as the enemy. They look at the competition as someone that's integral to their own development. And in the end, we are ultimately, our satisfaction is based entirely on how we do compared to how we could have done.
Yeah.
It's a very John Wooden kind of a thing.
Yep.
How you do compared to how you thought, what you thought your limit was. Because and for some people that's going for the gold. And for other people, and as I, you know, some people might say, oh well, you won a gold, so it's a different perspective. But I appreciate now, having won a gold and thought, oh, this didn't really change my life at all. What I admire and what I appreciate is where someone finishes relative to their expectations, well, relative to their starting point.
Yeah.
And that could be someone not qualifying for their Olympic team or giving the top dog a run for their money when they had no business giving the top dog a run for the money. That's what I, you know, or the mental aspects to it. Like the high jumper from Qatar who says, well, what if we didn't jump off? Would you have to give us both a gold medal? You know, that is, to me, that is next level beautiful. And I think we'll be talking about that for decades to come.
No doubt. And something that just kind of popped in there too, whereas you're saying like people's expectations. And of course we saw everything that went with Simone Biles, and she was just like mentally like exhausted, like I can't do this, right? And
yeah,
like, why
yeah.
can't you do it? And it's like, you should just go out there and do it, and you know, you got the physical traits and the abilities to do it, go ahead and do it. But people said like she could really injure herself if she's not mentally there, right? And so yeah. that's where, but and then her team won the silver and they're like, oh, they won the silver, okay. And it was like, well, for them, with everything that they were dealing with, that could be like, that's their gold, right? And it all depends on that athlete's perspective and what they want. So again, like you sharing, like maybe it's not making the Olympics, but like you just, like you said, gave the top dog the biggest run for their money. And they were like, who is this person, right? And of course it's not maybe a medal, but it's just something like you said, like it went beyond the expectations of that person competing. So I love that, especially because you are with U Sports and all that, and just with coaching and your experience as an athlete. And we were talking a little bit earlier about like just social media and all that other good stuff and bad stuff, depending on how you look at things.
Yep.
Do you feel athletes, and it's very similar to like when parents are like, oh, this generation's harder to parent because of X, Y, Z, but it's all relative because of what might be new to that generation of parents compared to the next generation of parents. But do you feel like athletes have it tougher or easier now than when you were coming up as an athlete?
Well, both probably.
Okay.
I mean, it's they all have the same playing field. I'm very happy, as many people our age and younger certainly have said, I'm very happy that there wasn't every single person walking around with a HD camera in their pocket when I was, you know, a high school student or a first time university student. The social media aspect of it, you know, who's your sponsor? I guess I got to take more pictures of myself today and tell everyone what I had for breakfast if I want to hope to get a sponsor. It's that we, now the American versus the Canadian system are two different things, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, that puts a whole nother level of strain. And I have a friend who's a psychologist, and half of her practice is working with the high school. And she says at that high school, fully half the kids have some mental health issue. And I can't help but think that social media plays a huge role in that. And so
100% agree.
Is life tougher now than it was when I was a kid? Well, I'm, you know, my parents thought TV was going to rot our mind, you know, and it's different. Now, I don't know that we'll necessarily know the repercussions of what the the kids today, isn't that, this is a cliche I use as a joke sometimes.
Yeah.
What the kids are going through right now, we won't know that right away, but you're already starting to see it in terms of, you know, calls to the, you know, the helpline and that sort of thing. So it's not good, but, you know, for some people, it's a better environment, and for others, it's a worse environment. It depends on the individual, but it's an even play, you know, and we've just watched the Tokyo Olympics a couple of months ago now, and people, you know, often you get mentioned, well, the environment that they've had to go through in the last, you know, 18 months or whatever it is, it's yes, totally valid, but that favors some people because everybody's going through the same environment.
Yep.
Or I shouldn't say that, because I'm a firefighter. My job has more or less continued as it was. And I know some people economically are going through the ringer right now. So I shouldn't say that, but.
No, again, I appreciate that. And I would say too, like when you're talking about high school kids and having mental health issues, I've told my kids, like, they're not going to have social media accounts, because when I was their age, I had maybe 100 set of eyes looking on me, judging me, feeling like, oh, well, that's how I felt, right? You go on social media, I'm not saying all aspects, but you're going to go in there, you post a picture, you post a random thought, or you're just putting something in the world. You might have like 15 likes, but then you're going to have like 150 people making fun of you or saying like, this is not how you should feel and all this other stuff. And at that age, they're trying to find themselves. They're trying to find their own identity. And for people that don't even know who they are, start like breaking them down or hurting them, it's like, you don't need that. I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't play one on TV, but I just feel like just the aspects of like, I put myself in their shoes when I was trying to find my identity. You don't need more and more people like keeping up negative things or doubt on you, right? So
yeah,
this is kind of my thoughts.
I'll throw my two cents in there if you don't mind.
Yeah,
it's for, and my wife and I have gone through this discussion 30 times, and my kids now each have their own phone. They're 14 and 17. And we delayed it and didn't like the idea. Well, eventually my wife wanted to know where they were all the time. And that was a big impetus. I'll not pretend that wasn't the case. But they don't. So we delayed it. And the comment was always, well, every other kid in my class has a phone, right? And the other argument, which is completely legitimate, is, well, that's how young people communicate these days. And it's hard to argue that that's not the case. Now, the positive as I see it is that my sons do relatively little posting of pictures of themselves.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm sure that if you studied this, or I'm sure someone has studied this, that there'd be a difference between boys and girls in that regard. And so maybe as a dad of two boys, I had it a little easier in that sense, but it's challenging. But when is, you have to walk that line. You know, when do you want them making these mistakes while they're still in the house? Yes. But if it's too early, you're setting them up for failure.
Yeah.
So I've seen, you know, my brother and sister-in-law gave their oldest kid a lot of responsibility when maybe he wasn't quite ready for it. And they might have waited a little longer if they had to do it again. I don't want to speak for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, nothing serious. But that's just another example that's really close to my experience.
Appreciate you sharing that, Duff. Yeah, we're kind of in the same boat with the mindset of like, you want to be around when they're experiencing the new tech, but you also want to make sure it's at an age where they can kind of respect it and understand. This is going to be a two-part, and then we'll finish off with the Fatherhood Quick Five. Again, as someone who is a fan of sports and especially the Olympics and everything that goes into it, take me into the experience of winning the gold medal in 2006, then also to the feeling of flying down the track. Because we could do simulations, and there's a possibility where people might be having a chance to go down an experience, go on a track and, you know, take the skeleton. But like for you as an Olympic athlete winning the gold, talk about that experience, then follow that up with just your experience just going down, you know, the track and what, like,
well,
into like words that I guess we can kind of feel your go on the journey with you, if that makes sense.
Well, I almost feel like I should start with the second one first, because you're going to be disappointed with it. It's
okay.
I don't know. People are expecting me to say, it's like the most amazing roller coaster you've ever seen in your life. There was this commercial. I don't remember. It was a famous hurdler was in this commercial. I don't remember the name, and I don't remember. This is decade or decades ago.
Yeah.
But it was like the point of the commercial was, what's as a world famous hurdler, what's going through your mind when you're doing it? And the answer was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, jump. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, jump. Or what, something along those lines, right? And it was like, well, I'm not sure what you expected there. And that's for skeleton. It's like, name something you've done 2,000 times before on the same track where it was remotely thrilling. I challenge you to, as your listeners' minds go in certain places there. What's going through my mind is I should be a few more inches to the right coming into this corner. It's an extreme, and I should be acting like a dead body because that's a better shock absorber than someone with muscular tension. That's what's going through my mind. And it doesn't have to do with reflexes. It has to do with timing.
So more or less like, you, of course, you're competing, so you're not enjoying the ride, but it's not something like not that I'm saying, oh, look at this, I'm going here. But like, you're like every step of the way, you're like, I could have done this better. I could have done this better. Like you're like almost like second guessing yourself or like trying to teach yourself for the next route, like how to do better, right? Or no?
Well, yeah. If it's your first time down that, let's say you're going to a World Cup on a German track or something, the first time down is, let's see what this feels like. I remember it last time, but the ice will be cut a little differently. It might be warmer or colder. So let's get a few runs under the belt and then you start fine tuning it. And if you are going to a World Championships or an Olympics, you have a lot more practice on that track before the race. At a World Cup, you get 3 days times two runs each day. And so it's a tremendous amount of mental rehearsal. I tried to do 100 in preparation for the Torino Olympics, which was where I won gold at. In a training week, the fall before, I tried to do 100 visualizations for every run down the track. And so that was about 4 hours of mental rehearsal for the 2 minutes of actually doing it on the track.
Yeah.
You're getting to such a fine line, and the nature of it, this is the path of a developing, same with bobsled, same with skeleton, same with luge, slider. You go down the track, you're new at it, you bang into the walls all the way down, and you go, well, I'm 4 seconds behind the top person. And that makes sense because you did terribly. And then you get better and better and better, just speaking about the driving aspect alone, and you make it all the way to the bottom and you don't touch the wall. And you look at the time, it's like, well, I'm still 2 seconds behind the best person. What am I missing? Well, that's where it becomes, you know, it's a science. And in skeleton and luge in particular, you are the shock absorber. And so do all of this at a high rate of speed under, sometimes for moments, probably 6 or 7 G-force, and do that without flexing a muscle in your body that you're not actually using in the performance of steering the sled. So it's such a precise, crazy thing that you would never do under any other circumstances.
Yeah, 100% appreciate the honesty and thank you for sharing that. Because it's like, again, we sometimes like have like this beautiful idea of like, this is what it's like. And like we put more maybe drama or unnecessary feelings under that, but you're like, you're technically looking at it from it like you're looking at it from a technical perspective to get better each day and each time you do it. So I appreciate that. Finish up with just before the Father Quick Five, like just the experience of winning the gold medal, being on the, you know, the stand and just hearing, you know, the national anthem from Canada being played while you're on the podium.
What can I say? That whole day was amazing and wonderful and interesting in many different ways. My wife had come to Italy with two of her good friends. And every once in a while, and this might sound really strange to say, but every once in a while, I'll think of it from their perspective or my wife's friend's perspective. Imagine if someone invited you to go to Italy to watch her significant other compete in an Olympic event and you went and they ended up winning. Like that would be, you know, that would be an incredible thing. And my wife and her two good friends still celebrate that trip, you know, independent of me.
Yeah.
And I think of my dad had passed a few months prior to the Torino Olympics, but I had won a world championships in 2004, also, you know, in Germany, which is the mecca of the sliding sports, in front of a few thousand fans. And back then there was no live, this was 2004, and I don't think they had the live streaming set up. That was right around then, but my dad basically watched his son win a world championship gold medal on a computer screen where it was a name and then it said 50 meter split. Here's the time, what's the ranking? At the end of corner two, here's the time, what's the ranking? That's how, like numbers popping up on a computer. And it's kind of a joyful thing for me to imagine him going through that and what that experience might have been like. But it's when I won, it was a, you know how I said it, there was it's an individual sport, and our team wasn't a team at first. Well, by the time we got to Torino, we had three members of our Olympic team who were all on such a level, and we coached each other. So the feedback, I got three times the amount of feedback I would have from a single coach, because I had teammates who were also doing it on such a high level, and we elevated higher than, you know, any of us could have independently. And we finished first, second, and fourth at the Torino Olympics. And it ended very late at night. And so the medal ceremony, they did a flower ceremony at the time, but there was a medal ceremony in Torino, which was an hour and a half drive away, the next day. And they got three different limousines to drive us. And we got the phone call from the prime minister, and my teammate was sitting beside me. And once we got to the city, the motorcycle cops drove ahead and stopped traffic, and we went right through the red lights. And I said, this is our 15 minutes. We're like rock stars. And he said, my teammate said, I'm pretty sure Mick Jagger has to stop for red lights. And it was like, you know what I mean? It's like I was 39 years old. I knew that was it. I was,
yeah,
blessed to go out at the top of my game, and we enjoyed every minute of it.
I love, yeah, it's like they always talk about, like, the quarterback winning the Super Bowl and retiring, right?
John Elway.
Yeah,
that's the best. That's the best retirement in sports.
Love it. Thank you very much for sharing all this. This, you know, of course, talking about your book, talking about fatherhood, and you know, the Olympics, and just training, and just your, you know, your perspective on things was amazing. So I appreciate that. Let's finish off with the Fatherhood Quick Five. Favorite family movie? Do you guys have one right now that you're watching together?
We don't really. We probably have never watched the same. I mean, the kids will watch. When they were young, they would have their DVD that they'd watch again and again. But I do recollect us watching 42 more than once.
Okay, nice.
And so that has a particular significance in our family, and relating to racism and that sort of thing, and broaching the use of the N-word, which was a part of that movie. So that's one as a family we've watched more than once. I was probably my youngest. You remember that scene where the kids said he discombobulated the man and threw the pitcher off and stole home? That's probably what my kid was imitating when we had to pull him out of the game in the first place.
Favorite family song, or is there a band or an artist you couldn't wait to introduce your kids to?
No. There is a giant chasm between mom and dad's music and the kids' music right now.
Gotcha.
I said, do I sound like I'm 20 years older than my age right now?
No.
That's I'm thinking, you know, the parents in the 50s where what's this rock and roll thing? It's the rap now. I don't know. There's a gap. There's a musical gap between kids and parents, I'd say.
Love it. Describe the perfect family vacation. Where would it be?
Well, it would be by water. We're big water ski, lake
nice
kind of people. And if we can afford it. It's not cheap to get there, but Hawaii is has been, we've gone there two or three times, and it's probably the favorite location.
Nice. Yeah, we want to get out there too. Like, we've never been out there, but we've been to a couple lake houses here in the States, and we just love it. It's just like, not my oldest and I aren't really beach people, but like the lake is like a great combination of water and hanging out. So
yeah.
Favorite sport to play as a family? Obviously, you know, just got to put the sports tie in there. Do you guys have one?
My wife's not as athletic as she, my wife has MS. So she is not as athletic as she once was. She's doing pretty good though. She has stabilized a lot and is not getting any worse. So touch wood, that's going really well.
Or it could be like favorite activity you guys like to do as a family, whether it's a board game, this or that. You can put it in that.
Well, I'd say we live in Calgary, we're really close to Banff, and getting out into the mountains, and we used to be a skiing family. Yeah. And a cycling. We still do. My wife has one of those e-bikes.
Okay.
So we ride bikes together occasionally, but we try and get to the lake together. That's the most fun, I'd say.
Nice. And top three words you hope your sons would use to describe you as a dad, what would they be?
Well, he tried. I honestly want them. I tell people for 10 years I've been writing two books, and one of them, COVID-19, has allowed me the time to put one to paper and get it out there. And the other one is really about some of the tougher, it's about the fact that the world doesn't treat all of its citizens the same way. Yeah. And I don't know, again, this is pretty heavy stuff. I don't know if I'll be able to change the world. I just want my kids to believe that I made an effort on their behalf.
Yeah, that's powerful and beautiful. And I talked to my kids about this. My family and I have these discussions. It's like, it's 2021, right? Like, how have we not evolved? You know, we have all this technology. We think we're, but like, unfortunately, I think sometimes things keep on going in circle, you know, cyclical patterns. And you're just like, we should be beyond this, right?
Yeah.
Everybody should be equal. And for some reason, I don't know why it doesn't compute in other people's heads, but I'm there with you, Duff. Like, I think everybody, it's not like it shouldn't be on a t-shirt, like every, you know, equality and all that stuff. Like, we should be actually pursuing this and partaking in equality. And I just, and for me, for the life of me, I don't get it. And I appreciate the strides you're doing. And I hope more and more people will turn to love and turn to acceptance and just turn to, you know, just equality and not just put on a bumper sticker and just say it for a month or something along those lines, but just every day, you know, have their kids. You always think you break the cycle of ignorance and racism and all that other stuff, but unfortunately it doesn't. And my, you know, your kids, my kids, we try and like teach them the, you know, like the golden rule. So hopefully in the future, maybe we won't see it. I wish we would, but who knows, but we just got to keep on, the more and more people are keep on trying and to, you know, keep equality and just love for everybody in there, I think hopefully we'll get there someday.
As we were saying before you started recording, on a certain level, it's really just about being nice.
Yeah.
And what is it about social media that makes it completely acceptable for someone to say the most hurtful thing after looking at your picture for 9 seconds on the internet? I have no idea. I have no idea what that is or why that works that way, but it's psychology in its worst way at play, I guess.
I hear you. Again, like, I feel like Duff, you and I could chat for pretty much like the whole day. I thank you for your time. I know we kind of went for an hour, but this was great. I appreciate your fatherhood journey. I appreciate your book, and I appreciate just you're kind of breaking down the Olympics and getting real with the Olympics instead of maybe just having like, you know, the way that fans of, you know, the Olympics see it. So I appreciate you giving the real answers and all that. People, make sure you follow him on Twitter at Duff Gibson. Pick up his book, The Tao of Sport, Reflecting on Purpose, Passion, and the Growth of a Hotbed of High Performance, wherever books are sold. Again, this was a blast. And like I said, I wish you and your family continued success, sir.
Thanks so much, Art. I sure enjoyed that.
Thanks for listening to the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and go to artoffatherhood.net.